Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for tuning in, and welcome back. Today we're going to talk about Einstein and his discoveries related to particles, waves, and the photoelectric effect. We have some nice images for you to look at while you're listening to the audio track, so open a second window and go to our website, guidetothecosmos.com, click on the microphone icon, and pull up today's show, Einstein, Particles, Waves, and the Photoelectric Effect. Let's begin by talking about what physicists believed about particles and waves before Einstein. Image number one on the website is a summary of how physicists viewed these two entities. They thought everything in the universe was either a particle or a wave, but certainly they had nothing in common. Particles were much simpler. You could think of them as being like small baseballs. They were easy to count and easy to know exactly where they were. All you had to do was look at one. Waves, on the other hand, were a lot more complicated. If you think about a sound wave, for example, sound is really not an object itself. Sound is the motion of a lot of much smaller objects, in this case, molecules of air. So when someone talks, what's happening is that they are exerting a pressure on the air molecules in front of their mouth. And those molecules exert a pressure on the molecules behind them, and so on and so on. And so this pressure wave spreads out from the person and fills an enormous volume. If you're in a room talking, the sound waves will reach every corner of the room. If a jet plane flies by outside, its sound waves will fill a vast area. So unlike particles, sound waves and other waves are not localized. They spread over a considerable area. They're also not quantized like particles are. You can have a wave of any amplitude that you wish. An ocean wave can be 1 foot tall or 2 feet tall or a foot and a half or anything that you'd like. Particles, on the other hand, always come in integer numbers. You can have one baseball or two, but never 1.5 baseballs. Another important difference between particles and waves has to do with their velocity. How fast do they move? Sound waves, for example, move through air at a speed that's determined by the properties of the air itself. They move at the speed of sound. We don't say that sound moves at the speed of voice sound, or the speed of car sound, or the speed of jet plane sound, because all of those different sounds move through the air at the same speed, at the speed of sound. It depends only on the properties of the air molecules, and it doesn't depend at all on what's the source of the sound in the first place, whether it's a person speaking, or a car, or a jet plane. Particles, on the other hand, can have any velocity at all. At least people thought so before Einstein. The more energy the particle has, the faster it's moving. And if you can supply enough energy, physicists believed the particle could have any velocity at all. Waves also do some very interesting things that no self-respecting particle would ever do, and that includes diffraction and interference. The second image on the website shows you an example of diffraction. In the upper half of the image, we have a wave. You might think of it, for instance, as being an ocean wave hitting a barrier, perhaps like a dike. The wave has alternating bands of white and black, and we can think of this as the white bands being the crests of the wave and the black bands being the troughs of the wave. The barrier obstructs the wave from moving forward, except that the barrier shown here has a small hole in the middle. So some of the wave that comes in from the left is able to go through the small hole in the barrier and continue moving on toward the right. But it does so in a very complicated way, as you see. The pattern on the right shows you that there is what's called a central lobe. Most of the wave energy goes forward, but spreads out gradually as it moves further and further from the barrier. So all the way at the right side of the image, the width of this central lobe is much larger than the width of the hole in the barrier that it went through. Next to the central lobe, there are some so-called dead zones where there's not much wave energy at all. And then further spread apart, there are again side lobes, more wave energy coming out at high angles. And then more dead zones and more side lobes and more dead zones and more side lobes, all the way out to an infinite number of side lobes at larger and larger angles from the original direction of the wave. So you have this complicated, rich structure of activity that's occurring downstream from the hole in the barrier. This is something that no particles ever do. If you had an array of particles hitting a barrier with a small hole in it, the particles that hit the barrier would simply stop, and the particles that hit the hole would continue to travel straight through the hole on a straight line forever and ever. There's no diffraction, there's no spreading, there's no dead zones, there's no side lobes. None of this complication exists with particles. They simply travel in a straight line at a constant velocity if there's no force acting on them. And another thing that distinguishes particles from waves is that particles can move through empty space. In fact, it's easier for them to move through empty space than anything else. Nothing to get in their way. Waves, on the other hand, need a medium. Sound waves need air, the molecules of air, to move to transmit the sound pressure wave forward. Ocean waves need the molecules of water. So this medium that waves require is a very different situation than particles that require no medium at all. So with this background, let's now look at the third image on the website, which illustrates the photoelectric effect and why it was such a mystery to scientists in the year 1900. It was discovered that if you shine light on a metal surface under the right conditions, you would be able to knock electrons out of the metal and create an electric current in the metal. So it makes sense that you need a certain amount of energy to knock these electrons out. The electrons are held to the nuclei of the atoms in the metal, and if you want to remove an electron and move it away from the positive charge in the nucleus that's holding it, that requires a certain amount of energy. So the beam of light that hit the metal surface had to have enough energy to remove an electron. But the mystery was that it had to have the right energy in a specific type of way, and people couldn't understand why that was. As the image shows, if you used yellow light, which is a relatively high frequency form of visible light, then you'd certainly knock out electrons. And even if you didn't have very much yellow light at all, you'd still knock out some electrons. You could turn the intensity of the yellow light down dramatically. You'd get less and less electrons, but still you'd always get some. On the other hand, if you used red light, you wouldn't get any electrons. And even if you turned the intensity of the red light way up, you still wouldn't get any electrons. Now, a very intense beam of red light might have much more energy than a very low-intensity beam of yellow light. But even though the red light might have more energy in total, it still wasn't able to eject any electrons at all. And no one could understand why. So as you had more and more red light, why weren't we able to extract electrons from the metal? What, after all, is wrong with red? Einstein was the person who was able to resolve this mystery. It was one of the famous papers that he published in 1905, his miracle year. And what Einstein said was, "We can understand this mystery of the photoelectric effect if we assume that light is actually made of particles." Now, everybody knew light was a wave. It did all the things that waves did. It had diffraction and interference, for example. It wasn't localized and it wasn't quantized. So what did Einstein mean by this, that light was also a particle? Well, what he said was that a beam of light is not just a stream of energy, as we think of a river as being a stream of water. He said, indeed, that the beam of light is actually composed of individual particles, huge number of individual particles, which we now call photons. And in fact, of course, a river of water is actually composed of individual particles too. These would be water molecules. So the photon is, in a sense, the atom of light. It is the particle that light is made of. And further, Einstein said, the energy of a photon is given by a new equation that he published, and that equation says that the energy of the photon is proportional to its frequency. Higher frequency photons have directly larger energies. Yellow light happens to have a relatively high frequency, and red light has a low frequency. So what Einstein said is that when a beam of light strikes the metal surface, even if it's a very intense beam of light, only one photon can hit an electron at a time. Even in a very intense beam, there aren't enough photons to have two photons hit the same electron at the same time. And only if that individual photon that's hitting the electron has sufficient energy to move it away from the nucleus, will you be able to kick the electron out of the metal. So the individual photon has to have enough energy to extract the electron, so it has to have, Einstein said, a high enough frequency to have that energy. Yellow light has a high enough frequency, and red light doesn't. So no matter how many red photons hit the surface, none of them have enough energy to knock out an electron. Whereas the yellow photons that hit the surface, all of them do have enough energy to knock out an electron, and the ones that hit the electrons in the right way do eject them. So that is why Einstein said yellow light creates this photoelectric effect and red light doesn't. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos. This is your host, Robert Piccioni, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back. I'm your host, Robert Piccioni, and you are listening to Guide to the Cosmos, and we're talking today about Einstein, particles, waves, and the photoelectric effect. We now know that light is a wave and a particle, and it is a combination of an electric and a magnetic field. Each photon consists of an electric field, which we can think of as oscillating or waving, let's say up and down, and a magnetic field, which is oscillating or waving left and right. And as the photon moves forward, it's oscillating up and down and left and right with its electric and its magnetic fields. The changing electric field causes the magnetic field. The changing magnetic field causes the electric field. And so this is like a waltz. The electric field drives the magnetic field, which drives the electric field, and so on. And the photon moves in a direction which is perpendicular to its electric field and perpendicular to its magnetic field. And that is shown in image number 5 on the website. And we characterize photons by the wavelength, the distance between the wave crests of either the electric or magnetic field, they're both the same, and frequency, which is sort of the inverse of the wavelength. The longer the wavelength, the lower the frequency. The higher the frequency, the shorter the wavelength. So Einstein's discovery that light could be both a particle and a wave, two things that everybody else at the time absolutely knew for sure were completely inconsistent with each other, this notion is called particle-wave duality, and it completely changed the face of physics. It is one of the cornerstones of the theory of quantum mechanics. Building on Einstein's discovery, others determined that particles also had wave properties, just as waves had particle properties. And now we know that everything really is both a particle and a wave. The word particle and the word wave are like the words black and white. They represent two extreme ends of a continuous spectrum. And everything in our universe is really a shade of gray. Almost nothing is completely black, and almost nothing is completely white. Everything is gray. Sometimes things look more wavish, sometimes things look more particle-ish, but ultimately everything has both particle properties and wave properties. This particle-wave duality is what's fundamentally responsible for the uncertainty that quantum mechanics predicts, and which has been confirmed by innumerable experiments. This was the uncertainty that Einstein rejected in an effort that lasted most of his life and was ultimately a lost cause. The uncertainty because of quantum mechanics, which results from the particle-wave duality that Einstein initiated, has become a cornerstone of modern physics. The photoelectric effect is now used in a wide variety of applications today. For instance, I think almost all of us have in an automatic garage door opener some sort of safety device that keeps the garage from closing on your car if you happen not to pull your car all the way into the garage. And that is a light beam that goes across the aperture of the garage door. And if you break the beam, you can't close the garage. Well, that light beam is detected at the opposite side of the garage by a photoelectric effect device. When the light hits the photoelectric effect device, there is a current because electrons are being knocked off the surface, and that current signals the safety interlock system that it's okay to close the garage door. If your car is blocking the light beam, there is no current from the photoelectric effect, and the interlock doesn't allow you to close the garage door. Similarly, in all sorts of industrial applications where we want to keep people from being injured by various machines, there is often a screen between the person and the machine, which is composed of some sort of light beam, and that if the person gets too close, they block the light beam, and that inhibits the action of the machine. Again, it's the photoelectric effect that detects the light beam and determines whether or not you're in the way. The photoelectric effect is also the basis for charge-coupled devices, which are used as the sensing element of all video cameras and digital cameras. So instead of film, we have this electronic device, which is based on the photoelectric effect. And such devices are thousands of times more sensitive than film. And so all modern telescopes, for example, which are starving for photons from distant galaxies, use these CCD imaging systems, both on the land-based telescopes and also in the space-based telescopes. The photoelectric effect is also the basis of how solar cells deliver electricity. It's used in reading your CDs and DVDs. A light beam bounces off the surface of the disc. Depending on the recording, the beam is either scattered into the photo receiver or not, and that gives us an electric signal. The photoelectric effect is also the basis of night vision goggles. It's also used in spectroscopy, electroscopy. It's the basis of a photomultiplier. It's also the active element inside a smoke detector. So the photoelectric effect really pervades our society, and understanding it, as Einstein did, allowed engineers to optimize the design and produce all of these marvelous applications that we all enjoy today. Thank you for joining us today. And remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.